Chapter 10. Shock. Introduction. Shock has a number of meanings. For example, it is often said that a person who has been frightened or received bad news is in shock. An electric current passing through the body delivers a shock. In this chapter, shock, hypoperfusion, describes a state of collapse and failure of the cardiovascular system. When the circulation of blood in the body becomes inadequate, the oxygen and nutrient needs of the cells cannot be met. In the early stages of shock, the body will attempt to maintain homeostasis, a balance of all systems of the body. However, as shock progresses, blood circulation slows and eventually ceases. This abnormal state of inadequate oxygen and nutrient delivery to the cells of the body causes organs and then organ systems to fail. If not treated promptly, shock can be fatal. Shock can occur because of several medical or traumatic events, such as a heart attack, severe allergic reaction, an automobile crash, or a gunshot wound. As an EMT, you will respond to these different types of emergencies to provide care and transportation for these patients. Therefore, you must be constantly alert to the signs and symptoms of shock. In general, you cannot go wrong assuming that every patient is in shock or may go into shock. Treat every patient for shock. This chapter begins with a close-up look at perfusion, the function that fails in shock. Next, it looks at the physiologic causes of shock and describes each of its major forms. Finally, it discusses the emergency treatment of shock in general and of each kind of shock in particular. See Chapter 11, BLS Resuscitation for Resuscitation Techniques. Pathophysiology. Perfusion. Perfusion is the circulation of blood within an organ or tissue in adequate amounts to meet the cell's current needs for oxygen, nutrients, and waste removal. The body is perfused via the circulatory system. The circulatory system is a complex arrangement of connected tubes, including the arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins. There are two circuits in the body, the systemic circulation in the body and the pulmonary circulation in the lungs. The systemic circulation, the circuit in the body, carries oxygen-rich blood from the left ventricle through the body and back to the right atrium. In the systemic circulation, as blood passes through the tissues and organs, it gives up oxygen and nutrients and absorbs cellular wastes and carbon dioxide. Perfusion is an important part of the process by which waste products, such as carbon dioxide made by the cells, are removed. It is also important to understand the physiology of respiration because organs, tissues, and cells must have adequate oxygenation or they may die. Each time you take a breath, the alveoli, which are microscopic, thin-walled air sacs, receive a supply of oxygen-rich air. The oxygen then dissolves in the blood plasma and attaches to the blood's hemoglobin. The oxygenated blood passes through the alveolar wall into the walls of a fine network of pulmonary capillaries that are in close contact with the alveoli. If the oxygenated blood is not properly circulated, some of the cells and organs will not receive proper nutrients, possibly resulting in cell death. Oxygen and carbon dioxide pass rapidly across these thin tissue layers through diffusion. Diffusion is a passive process in which molecules move from an area with a higher concentration of molecules to an area of lower concentration. There are more oxygen molecules in the alveoli than in the blood. Therefore, the oxygen molecules move from the alveoli into the blood. Because there are more carbon dioxide molecules in the blood than in the inhaled air, carbon dioxide moves from the blood into the alveoli. Just like oxygen, carbon dioxide is dissolved in the plasma and attaches to the blood's hemoglobin. The body takes the carbon dioxide, combines it with water, and creates sodium bicarbonate. Sodium bicarbonate concentrations become very high just as the blood is moving toward the lungs. Once it reaches the lungs, the sodium bicarbonate breaks down and the carbon dioxide is exhaled. All of this action takes place to maintain the delicate balance between the gases. If there is a disturbance in the transportation of carbon dioxide, dangerous waste products will build up in the cells and organs, leading to cell or organ death. Shock, or hypoperfusion, refers to a state of collapse and failure of the cardiovascular system that leads to inadequate circulation. Like internal bleeding, shock is an unseen underlying life threat caused by a medical disorder or traumatic injury. To protect vital organs, the body attempts to compensate by directing blood flow from organs that are more tolerant of low flow, such as the skin and intestines, to organs that cannot tolerate low blood flow, such as the heart, brain, and lungs. If the conditions causing shock are not promptly addressed, the patient will soon die. However, you can recognize the signs and symptoms of shock early and initiate treatment for this life threat soon after the onset of shock. The cardiovascular system consists of three parts: a pump, the heart, a set of pipes, the blood vessels or arteries that act as the container, and the contents of the container, the blood. These three parts can be referred to as the perfusion triangle. When a patient is in shock, one or more of the three parts is not working properly. Blood is the vehicle for carrying oxygen and nutrients through the vessels, to the capillary beds, to tissue cells, where these supplies are exchanged for waste products. For this process to happen, the vessels, container, must be intact. Blood contains red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, and a liquid called plasma. As discussed in Chapter 5, The Human Body, red blood cells are responsible for the transportation of oxygen to the cells and for transporting carbon dioxide, a waste product of cellular metabolism, away from the cells to the lungs, where it is exhaled and removed from the body. White blood cells help the body to fight infection. Platelets are responsible for forming blood clots. In the body, a blood clot forms depending on one of the following principles: retention of blood due to blockage in blood circulation, blood stasis, changes in the vessel wall, such as a wound, and the blood's ability to clot as the result of a disease process or medication. When injury occurs to tissues in the body, platelets begin to collect at the site of injury. This causes the red blood cells to become sticky and clump together. As the red blood cells begin to clump, another substance in the body called fibrinogen reinforces the red blood cells. This is the final step in the formation of a blood clot. Blood clots are an important response from the body to control blood loss. However, be aware that clots are unstable and prone to rupture because blood keeps moving as a result of pressure that is generated by the contractions of the heart and the actions of the blood vessels as they dilate and constrict. This pressure, which we call blood pressure, is usually carefully controlled by the body so that there is always sufficient circulation or perfusion in the various tissues and organs. Blood pressure is, in fact, a rough measure of perfusion. Remember that blood pressure is really the pressure of blood within the vessels at any one time. The systolic pressure is the peak arterial pressure, or pressure generated every time the heart contracts. The diastolic pressure is the pressure maintained within the arteries while the heart rests between heartbeats. Blood flow through the capillary beds is regulated by the capillary sphincters, circular muscular walls that constrict and dilate. These sphincters are under the control of the autonomic nervous system, which regulates involuntary functions such as sweating and digestion. Capillary sphincters also respond to other stimuli such as heat, cold, the need for oxygen, and the need for waste removal. Keep in mind that, under normal circumstances, not all cells have the same needs at the same time. For example, the stomach and intestines have a high need for blood flow during and shortly after eating, when digestion is at a peak. Between meals, blood flow is lessened, and blood is diverted to other areas. The brain, by contrast, needs a constant and consistent supply of blood to function. Thus, regulation of blood flow is determined by cellular need and is accomplished by vessel constriction or dilation, together with sphincter constriction or dilation. Maintenance of blood flow or perfusion is accomplished by the heart, blood vessels, and blood working together. Perfusion requires more than just having a working cardiovascular system, however. It also requires adequate oxygen exchange in the lungs, adequate nutrients in the form of glucose in the blood, and adequate waste removal, primarily through the lungs. Carbon dioxide is one of the primary waste products of cellular work, metabolism, in the body, and is removed from the body by the lungs. This is the reason adequate ventilation and oxygenation is one of your primary concerns. The body has neural and hormonal mechanisms in place to help support the respiratory and cardiovascular systems when the need for perfusion of vital organs is increased. These mechanisms, including the autonomic nervous system and certain chemicals called hormones, are triggered when the body senses that the pressure in the system is falling. The sympathetic side of the autonomic nervous system, which is responsible for the fight or flight response, will assume more control of the body's functions during a state of shock. The parasympathetic nervous system is a division of the autonomic nervous system that controls involuntary functions by sending signals to the cardiac, smooth, and glandular muscles. This response by the autonomic nervous system causes the release of hormones, such as epinephrine and norepinephrine. These hormones cause changes in certain body functions, such as an increase in the heart rate and in the strength of cardiac contractions and vasoconstriction in non-essential areas, primarily in the skin and gastrointestinal tract, peripheral vasoconstriction. Together, these actions are designed to maintain pressure in the system and, as a result, sustain perfusion of all vital organs. Eventually, there is also a shifting of body fluids to help maintain pressure within the system. However, the response of the autonomic nervous system and hormones comes within seconds. It is this response that causes all the signs and symptoms of shock in a patient. Causes of shock. Shock can result from many conditions, including bleeding, respiratory failure, acute allergic reactions, and overwhelming infection. In all cases, however, the damage occurs because of insufficient perfusion of organs and tissues. As soon as perfusion stops or becomes impaired, tissues start to die, affecting all local body processes. If the conditions causing shock are not promptly arrested and reversed, death soon follows. Understanding the basic physiologic causes of shock will better prepare you to treat it. There are three basic causes of shock. Types of shock. Cardiogenic shock. Cardiogenic shock is caused by inadequate function of the heart or pump failure. Circulation of blood throughout the vascular system requires the constant pumping action of a normal and vigorous heart muscle. Many diseases or injury can cause destruction or inflammation of this muscle. Within certain limits, the heart can adapt to these problems. If too much muscular damage occurs, however, as sometimes happens after a heart attack, the heart no longer functions well. A major effect is the backup of blood into the lungs. The resulting buildup of fluid within the pulmonary tissue is called pulmonary edema. Edema is the presence of abnormally large amounts of fluid between cells in body tissues, causing swelling of the affected area. Pulmonary edema leads to impaired ventilation, which may be manifested by an increased respiratory rate and abnormal lung sounds. The muscular contraction of the heart moves blood through the vessels at distinct pressures. For blood to circulate efficiently throughout the entire system, there must be the right amount of pressure and an adequate number of heartbeats. For this reason, the heart has its own electrical system that initiates and regulates its beating. Disease or injury can damage or destroy this system, causing irregular and uncoordinated beats, beats that are too slow, fewer than 60 beats per minute, or beats that are too fast, more than 100 beats per minute. Cardiogenic shock develops when the heart cannot maintain sufficient output, cardiac output, to meet the demands of the body. Cardiac output is the volume of blood that the heart can pump per minute, and it is dependent upon several factors. First, the heart must have adequate strength, which is largely determined by the ability of the heart muscle to contract. This ability to contract is referred to as myocardial contractility. Second, the heart must receive adequate blood to pump. As the volume of blood coming to the heart increases, the pre-contraction pressure in the heart builds up. This pre-contraction pressure is known as preload. As preload increases, the volume of blood within the ventricles increases, which causes the heart muscle to stretch. When the muscle is stretched, myocardial contractility increases, leading to greater force of contraction and increased cardiac output. Lastly, the resistance to flow in the peripheral circulation must be appropriate. The force or resistance against which the heart pumps is known as afterload. In general, as afterload increases, cardiac output decreases. Increased afterload may also cause the heart to overwork while trying to maintain adequate cardiac output. High afterload is often the reason that heart failure develops in patients with hypertension. Cardiogenic shock may result from low cardiac output due to high afterload, low preload, poor contractility, or any combination of the three. Obstructive shock. Obstructive shock results when conditions that cause mechanical obstruction of the cardiac muscle also impact pump function. Two of the most common examples of obstructive shock are cardiac tamponade and tension pneumothorax. A collection of fluid between the pericardial sac and the myocardium is a cardiac tamponade, also called a pericardial tamponade. It is caused by blunt or penetrating trauma and can progress rapidly. Cardiac tamponade occurs when blood leaks into the tough fibrous membrane known as the pericardium, causing an accumulation of blood within the pericardial sac. This accumulation leads to compression of the heart. Because the pericardium has a limited ability to stretch, each contraction of the heart allows more blood accumulation between the heart and the sac. The accumulated blood prevents the heart from opening up to allow complete refilling. Continued pressure within the pericardial sac obstructs the flow of blood into the heart, resulting in decreased outflow from the heart. Signs and symptoms of cardiac tamponade are referred to as Beck's triad: the presence of jugular vein distension, muffled heart sounds, and systolic and diastolic blood pressure starting to merge. Systolic pressure drops and the diastolic pressure rises. Another obstructive condition occurs with a tension pneumothorax. A tension pneumothorax is caused by damage to the lung tissue. This damage allows air normally held within the lung to escape into the chest cavity. If a pneumothorax is allowed to continue untreated, a sufficient amount of air will accumulate within the chest cavity and begin applying pressure to the structures in the mediastinum. The primary organs in this area are the heart and great vessels, aorta and vena cava. When the trapped air begins to shift the chest organs toward the uninjured side, a pneumothorax becomes known as a tension pneumothorax, which is a very serious and life-threatening condition. As pressure from one side of the chest begins to push the mediastinum toward the other side, the vena cava loses its ability to stay fully expanded. This mechanical compression of the vessel leads to reduced return of blood to the heart. The patient becomes anxious and short of breath. The heart and respiratory rates increase and become shallower. Blood pressure drops. You may notice difficulty when attempting to ventilate the patient with a bag mask device as well. The affected side will have decreased or absent lung sounds, and the patient will become cyanotic. Tracheal deviation may be a late sign of tension pneumothorax. Distributive shock. Distributive shock results when there is widespread dilation of the small arterioles, small venules, or both. As a result, the circulating blood volume pools in the expanded vascular beds and tissue perfusion decreases. The four most common types of distributive shock are septic shock, neurogenic shock, anaphylactic shock, and psychogenic shock. Septic shock. Septic shock occurs as a result of severe infections, usually bacterial, in which toxins, poisons, are generated by the bacteria or by infected body tissues. In this condition, the toxins damage the vessel walls, causing increased cellular permeability. The vessel walls leak and are unable to contract well. Widespread dilation of vessels in combination with plasma loss through the injured vessel walls results in shock. Septic shock is a complex problem. First, there is an insufficient volume of fluid in the container because much of the plasma has leaked out of the vascular system, hypovolemia. Second, the fluid that has leaked out often collects in the respiratory system, interfering with ventilation. Third, the vasodilation leads to a larger than normal vascular bed to contain the smaller than normal volume of intravascular fluid. Septic shock is almost always a complication of a very serious illness, injury, or surgery. Neurogenic shock. Damage to the spinal cord, particularly at the upper cervical levels, may cause significant injury to the part of the nervous system that controls the size and muscular tone of the blood vessels. Neurogenic shock is usually the result. Although not as common, there are medical causes as well. These include brain conditions, tumors, pressure on the spinal cord, and spina bifida. In neurogenic shock, the muscles in the walls of the blood vessels are cut off from the sympathetic nervous system and nerve impulses that cause them to contract. Therefore, all vessels below the level of the spinal injury dilate widely, increasing the size and capacity of the vascular system and causing blood to pool. The available 6 liters of blood in the body can no longer fill the enlarged vascular system. Even though no blood or fluid has been lost, perfusion of organs and tissues becomes inadequate and shock occurs. In this condition, a radical change in the size of the vascular system has caused shock. Characteristic signs of this type of shock are the absence of sweating below the level of injury and normal warm skin. Anaphylactic shock. Anaphylaxis, or anaphylactic shock, occurs when a person reacts violently to a substance to which he or she has been sensitized. Sensitization means becoming sensitive to a substance that did not initially cause a reaction. Do not be misled by a patient who reports no history of allergic reaction to a substance on first or second exposure. Each subsequent exposure after sensitization tends to produce a more severe reaction. Instances that cause severe allergic reactions commonly fall into the following 4 categories of exposure. Injections, tetanus antitoxin, penicillin. Stings, honeybee, wasp, yellowjacket, hornet. Ingestion, shellfish, fruit, medication. Inhalation, dust, pollen. Anaphylactic reactions can develop within minutes or even seconds after contact with the substance to which the patient is allergic. The signs of such allergic reactions are very distinct and not seen with other forms of shock. Table 10.2 lists the signs of anaphylactic shock in the order in which they typically occur. Note that cyanosis, bluish color of the skin, is a late sign of anaphylactic shock. In anaphylactic shock, there is no loss of blood, no mechanical vascular damage, and only a slight possibility of direct cardiac muscular injury. Instead, there is widespread vascular dilation, increased permeability, and bronchoconstriction. The combination of poor oxygenation and poor perfusion in anaphylactic shock may easily prove fatal. Psychogenic shock. A patient in psychogenic shock has had a sudden reaction of the nervous system that produces a temporary, generalized vascular dilation, resulting in fainting or syncope. Blood pools in the dilated vessels, reducing the blood supply to the brain. As a result, the brain ceases to function normally, and the patient faints. While there are many causes of syncope, it is important to realize that some are of a serious nature, but others are not. Causes of syncope that are potentially life-threatening result from events such as an irregular heartbeat or a brain aneurysm. Other non-life-threatening events that cause syncope may be the receipt of bad news or experiencing fear or unpleasant sights, like the sight of blood. Hypovolemic shock. Hypovolemic shock is the result of an inadequate amount of fluid or volume in the system. There are hemorrhagic and non-hemorrhagic causes of hypovolemic shock. Injuries may result in hemorrhagic shock, while vomiting and diarrhea may result in non-hemorrhagic hypovolemic shock. Hypovolemic shock also occurs with severe thermal burns. In this case, it is intravascular plasma, the colorless part of the blood that is lost, leaking from the circulatory system into the burned tissues that lie adjacent to the injury. Likewise, crushing injuries may result in the loss of blood and plasma from damaged vessels into injured tissues. Dehydration, the loss of water or fluid from body tissues, can cause or aggravate shock. Fluid loss may be a result of severe vomiting and/or diarrhea. Patients who are very young or elderly are particularly susceptible to fluid loss and therefore at risk for developing shock through dehydration. People who exercise in hot weather and are not accustomed to it may experience dehydration if they do not drink enough fluids. In these circumstances, the common factor is an insufficient volume of blood within the vascular system to provide adequate circulation to the organs of the body. Respiratory insufficiency. A patient with a severe chest injury, such as flail chest or obstruction of the airway, may be unable to breathe in an adequate amount of oxygen. This affects the ventilation process of respiration. Enough oxygen cannot be inspired to meet the metabolic demand. An insufficient concentration of oxygen in the blood can produce shock as rapidly as vascular causes, even if the volume of blood, the volume of the vessels, and the action of the heart are all normal. Without oxygen, the organs in the body cannot survive, and their cells promptly start to deteriorate. Certain types of poisoning may affect the ability of cells to metabolize or carry oxygen. Carbon monoxide has a 250 times greater affinity for hemoglobin than oxygen. If a patient is in an environment where they inhale carbon monoxide, it will bind to the hemoglobin, forming carboxyhemoglobin rather than allowing oxygen to bind. This results in a hypoxic state if not corrected. Cyanide impairs the ability of cells to metabolize oxygen within the cell, and cellular asphyxia may occur. Anemia occurs when there is an abnormally low number of red blood cells. Red blood cells contain hemoglobin, an iron-containing pigment. Hemoglobin transports oxygen from the lungs to the tissues. Each hemoglobin molecule is able to carry 4 molecules of oxygen. Anemia may be the result of either chronic or acute bleeding, a deficiency in certain vitamins or minerals, or an underlying disease process. If anemia is present, tissues may be hypoxic because the blood may not be able to carry adequate oxygen even though the hemoglobin is fully saturated. In this situation, a pulse oximeter may indicate that there is adequate saturation even though the tissues are hypoxic. This type of hypoxia is known as hypoxemic hypoxia. The progression of shock. Although you cannot see shock, you can see its signs and symptoms. The early stage of shock, while the body can still compensate for blood loss, is called compensated shock. The late stage, when blood pressure is falling, is called decompensated shock. The last stage, when shock has progressed to a terminal stage, is called irreversible shock. A transfusion during irreversible shock will not save the patient's life. Remember that blood pressure may be the last measurable factor to change in shock. As we have seen, the body has several automatic mechanisms to compensate for initial blood loss and to help maintain blood pressure. Thus, by the time you detect a drop in blood pressure, shock is well developed. This is particularly true in infants and children, who can maintain their blood pressure until they have lost more than half their blood volume. By the time blood pressure drops in infants and children who are in shock, they are close to death. The EMT must also use caution when caring for elderly patients. As a result of the aging process, elderly patients generally have more serious complications than younger patients. Although illness is a common complaint among the elderly, you must understand that it is not just part of aging. Keep in mind the following signs of the normal aging process when managing geriatric patients. The central nervous system often has a delayed response. The cardiovascular system has a variety of changes that result in a decrease in the efficiency of the system. On assessment, be alert for higher resting heart rates and irregular pulse rates. The respiratory system has significant changes as the elasticity of the lungs and their size and strength decrease. On assessment, be alert for higher respiratory rates, lower tidal volume, and a decreased gag reflex. In addition, you must remember that cervical arthritis may be present and that dentures may cause an airway obstruction. The skin becomes thinner, drier, less elastic and more fragile, thus providing less protection and thermal regulation, cold and hot. The renal system decreases in function and may not respond well to unusual demands such as illness. The gastrointestinal system sustains changes in gastric motility that may lead to slower gastric emptying. Treating a pediatric or geriatric patient in shock is no different than treating any other shock patient. 1. Provide inline spinal stabilization if indicated. If spinal immobilization is not indicated, maintain the patient in a position of comfort. 2. Suction as necessary and provide high-flow oxygen via a non-rebreathing mask. 3. Control bleeding. 4. Maintain body temperature. 5. Provide rapid transportation. You should expect shock in many emergency medical situations. For example, you would expect shock to accompany massive external or internal bleeding. You should also expect shock if a patient has any one of the following conditions: multiple severe fractures, abdominal or chest injury, spinal injury, a severe infection, a major heart attack, anaphylaxis. Patient assessment for shock. Scene size up. Scene safety. As you approach the scene, be alert to potential hazards to your safety, such as downed power lines, fast-moving traffic, or anything else that threatens your safety. Once on scene, look for and address hazards and threats to the safety of the crew, bystanders, and the patient. If this is a trauma scene or bleeding is suspected, put on gloves and eye protection at a minimum. Put several pairs of gloves in your pocket for easy access in case your gloves tear or there are multiple patients with bleeding. At vehicle crashes, ensure that there is no leaking fuel in the area where you will be working and that energized electrical lines are not close to where you will be working. If you are called to a two-car collision, how many patients are possible? 2 or 8? Do you have the necessary resources available? Consider early what you may need and verify as you begin to form your initial general impression. The sooner you call for help, the sooner it will arrive. In incidents involving violence, such as assaults or gunshot wounds, make sure that police are on scene. At times, you may need to stage several blocks away until law enforcement personnel have secured the area. Mechanism of injury, nature of illness. When you first see the patient, observe the scene and patient for clues to determine the nature of the illness or the mechanism of injury. Medical complaints typically involve only one patient, but always ensure that you only have one patient to care for. It is not uncommon that trauma incidents involve more than one patient. Obtain an accurate account of all patients. Primary assessment. The primary assessment for a patient with suspected shock should include a rapid scan of the patient to determine level of consciousness, identify and manage life-threatening concerns, and determine priority of the patient and transport. Treating according to the ABCs is always a good choice. Threats to airway, breathing, or circulation are considered life-threatening and must be treated immediately to prevent mortality. In some situations, significant bleeding may require management before applying oxygen for a person with adequate breathing. Significant bleeding, internal or external, is an immediate life threat. If the patient has obvious life-threatening bleeding, it must be controlled quickly and treatment of shock begun as quickly as possible. The decision on what to treat first will come with experience. Provide high-flow oxygen to assist in perfusion of damaged tissues. If the patient has signs of hypoperfusion, treat aggressively and provide rapid transport to the hospital. Request advanced life support, ALS, as necessary to assist with more aggressive shock management. Do not delay transport of the seriously injured trauma patient to complete non-life-saving treatments in the field, such as splinting extremity fractures. Instead, complete these types of treatments en route to the hospital. Form a general impression. When you first visualize your patient, quickly form an initial general impression. This includes age, sex, signs of distress, obvious life-threatening injuries, abnormal positioning, and skin color. These observations will help you develop an early sense of urgency for care of a patient who appears sick. Once you are close to the patient, determine the need for manual spinal immobilization and assess the patient's level of consciousness using the AVPU, alert to person, place, and day, responsive to verbal stimuli, responsive to pain, unresponsive scale. A patient who has an altered level of consciousness, LOC, may need emergency airway management. If the patient is awake and alert, determine a chief complaint. Airway and breathing. Next, quickly assess the airway to ensure it is patent. If the patient is awake and answering questions, the airway is patent. Be alert to abnormal airway sounds such as gurgling, suction the airway, or stridor, indicating partial airway obstruction. If the patient is awake and answering questions, an airway adjunct is not needed. Consider an adjunct such as an oropharyngeal or nasopharyngeal airway for a patient with an altered LOC. Next, you must quickly assess breathing in the patient. You must inspect and palpate the chest wall to assess for decap VTLS. Deformities, contusions, abrasions, punctures, penetrations, burns, tenderness, lacerations, and swelling. Observe the patient for signs of accessory muscle use, such as the muscles of the neck, intercostal retractions, or abnormal use of the abdominal muscles. An increased respiratory rate is often an early sign of impending shock. You must assess the patient's breath sounds with a stethoscope, listening for wheezes or other abnormal breath sounds. Once you have quickly completed this assessment of breathing, give the patient high-flow oxygen, or if needed, assist respirations with a bag mask device. Circulation. Next, you must quickly assess the patient's circulatory status. Check for the presence of a distal pulse. If you cannot obtain a distal pulse, assess for a central pulse. Make a rapid determination if the pulse is fast, slow, weak, strong, or altogether absent. A rapid pulse suggests compensated shock. In shock or compensated shock, the skin may be cool, clammy, or ashen. If the patient has no pulse and is not breathing, immediately begin cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR. In trauma patients, ensure you have assessed for and identified any life-threatening bleeding. If serious bleeding is discovered, treat it at once. You must also quickly assess skin temperature, condition, and color. Also check for capillary refill time. Transport decision. Once you have assessed perfusion, you can determine whether the patient should be treated as high priority, whether ALS is needed, and which facility to transport to. Trauma patients with shock or a suspicious mechanism of injury, MOI, generally should go to a trauma center. Sometimes local protocols dictate that a patient should be transported to the nearest hospital for stabilization prior to transfer to a definitive treatment center. History taking. Investigate chief complaint. After the life threats have been managed during the primary assessment, determine the chief complaint. The EMT should obtain a medical history and be alert for injury-specific signs and symptoms, as well as any pertinent negatives such as loss of sensation. Sample history. You must now quickly obtain a sample history from the patient. Remember, if the patient has a significant change in LOC before arrival at the hospital, you should provide the hospital personnel with this important information. Secondary assessment. The secondary assessment is a more detailed, comprehensive examination of the patient that is used to uncover injuries that may have been missed during the primary assessment. The secondary assessment begins by repeating the primary assessment, followed by a focused assessment. in some instances, such as a critically injured patient or short transport time, you may not have time to conduct a secondary assessment. Physical examinations. If significant trauma has likely affected multiple systems, start with a full body scan to be sure that you have identified all injuries. Next, assess the respiratory system. This should involve looking, listening, and feeling. When assessing the respiratory system, look at the patient and ask yourself the following questions. 1. Is the patient's respiratory rate and quality within normal limits? 2. What is the patient's skin color and condition? 3. Are there any signs of increased respiratory efforts such as retractions, nasal flaring, stridor, or use of accessory muscles? Next, listen for air movement at the patient's mouth and nose. Then, listen to breath sounds with a stethoscope. Breath sounds should be clear and equal bilaterally, anteriorly, and posteriorly. Determine the patient's rate and quality of respiration. Finally, assess asymmetrical chest wall movement. You must be able to quickly assess the pulse rate and quality. Determine the skin condition, color, and temperature, and check the capillary refill time. Assess the neurologic system to gather baseline data on your patient. This examination should include level of consciousness, use AVPU, pupil size and reactivity, motor response, sensory response. Assess the musculoskeletal system by doing a detailed full body scan. Look for decap BTLS. Assess the chest, abdomen, and extremities for hidden bleeding and injuries. Log roll the patient and assess the posterior torso for injuries as well. Once the back has been assessed, the patient can be log rolled back down onto a backboard, followed by complete spinal stabilization. Log rolling and securing the patient to a backboard or other full-body stabilization device should take into consideration injuries found during the primary assessment. Assess all anatomic regions looking for the following signs, symptoms. Be alert for raccoon eyes, battle sign, and or drainage of blood or fluid from the ears or nose. Check the neck for jugular vein distension and tracheal deviation. Be alert for patients with a stoma or tracheostomy. Check the pelvis for stability. Check the abdomen. Feel all four quadrants for tenderness or rigidity. If the abdomen is tender, expect internal bleeding. Check the extremities and record pulse, motor, and sensory function. If your patient is a trauma patient with a significant mechanism of injury or multiple injuries, one who gives you a poor initial general impression, or you found problems in the primary assessment, perform a rapid full body scan. If your patient has a medical problem but is not responsive or problems were noted in the primary assessment, perform a rapid full body scan. These scans should be performed quickly but thoroughly to ensure that you do not miss any significant or life-threatening problems or delay needed care. If your patient has only a simple mechanism of injury, such as a twisted ankle, focus your examination on the area affected. Whether your examination is rapid or focused, if a life-threatening problem is found, treat it immediately. When time permits and the patient's condition is stable, perform a thorough examination of the patient. This includes a complete neurologic assessment. Vital signs. Obtain a complete set of baseline vital signs. If the patient's condition is unstable or could become unstable, reassess vital signs every 5 minutes. If the patient is in stable condition, reassess vital signs every 10 to 15 minutes. Baseline vital signs will help you trend changes in your patient. Monitoring devices. In addition to hands-on assessment, you should use monitoring devices to quantify the patient's oxygenation and circulatory status. Use a non-invasive technique to monitor blood pressure and a pulse oximeter to evaluate the effectiveness of oxygenation. It is recommended to assess the patient's blood pressure with a sphygmomanometer, blood pressure cuff, and stethoscope manually before using a non-invasive blood pressure monitor to establish a baseline blood pressure and to determine the accuracy of the non-invasive blood pressure monitor. Reassessment. This portion of patient assessment is very important in patient care. The rule of thumb is assess, intervene, reassess. This portion of the assessment revisits the primary assessment, the vital signs, the chief complaint, and any treatment performed on the patient, including oxygen administration. You must assess the patient to determine whether the interventions you performed are having any effect on the patient. This step prepares you to present the patient at the hospital with a complete, concise account of the patient encounter and care. Interventions. You must determine what interventions are needed for your patient at this point based on the findings of your assessment. You should focus on supporting the cardiovascular system. Treating for shock early and aggressively will help to prevent inadequate perfusion from harming your patient. Provide oxygen and put the patient in the shock position. Communication and documentation. Patients who are in decompensated shock will need rapid interventions to restore adequate perfusion. The hospital may or may not have suggestions on how best to support a patient's failing cardiovascular system. Most of the interventions used to treat shock do not require a specific physician's order. However, some do. Determine based on the signs and symptoms found in your assessment whether your patient is in compensated or decompensated shock. Document these findings after you have treated for shock. Emergency medical care for shock. You must begin immediate treatment for shock as soon as you realize that the condition may exist. Follow the steps in Skill Drill 10-1. Skill Drill 10-1. 1. As with any type of patient care, you should begin by following standard precautions and by making sure the patient has an open airway. Maintain manual inline stabilization if necessary, and check breathing and pulse. Comfort, calm, and reassure the patient while maintaining the patient in the supine position. Never allow patients to eat or drink anything prior to being evaluated by a physician. Patients who have had a severe heart attack or who have lung disease may find it easier to breathe in a sitting or semi-sitting position. 2. Next, control all obvious external bleeding. Place dry, sterile dressings over the bleeding sites and secure with bandages. If direct pressure is not rapidly successful in the control of bleeding from an extremity, apply a tourniquet proximal to the bleeding site according to local protocol. 3. Splint the patient on a backboard. Do not delay transport by applying individual splints in the field. If possible, splint individual extremity fractures during transport. This minimizes pain, bleeding, and discomfort, all of which can aggravate shock. It also prevents the broken bone ends from further damaging adjacent soft tissue. In general, splinting will make it easier to move the patient. Handle the patient gently and no more than is necessary. 4. Remember that inadequate ventilation may be the primary cause of shock or a major factor in its development. Always provide oxygen, assist with ventilations, and use airway control adjuncts as needed. And continue to monitor the patient's breathing. To prevent the loss of body heat, place blankets under and over the patient. Be careful not to overload the patient with covers or attempt to warm the body too much. It is best for the patient to maintain a normal body temperature. Do not use external heat sources, such as hot water bottles or heating pads. They may harm a patient in shock by causing vasodilation and decreasing blood pressure even more. 5. Once you have positioned the patient on a backboard or a stretcher, place the patient in the Trendelenburg's position. This technique is easily accomplished by raising the foot of the backboard or stretcher about 6 inches to 12 inches. If the patient is not on a backboard and no lower extremity fractures are suspected, place the patient in the shock position. This is accomplished by elevating the patient's legs 6 inches to 12 inches by propping them up on several blankets or other stable objects. These positions help to return blood from the extremities back to the core of the body where it is needed most. Patients with respiratory distress may benefit from the Trendelenburg's position, but the lower extremities should be raised only 6 inches to 8 inches. Raising the lower extremities any higher may aggravate a patient's breathing because the abdominal organs push against the diaphragm. 6. Transport the patient and treat additional injuries en route. Do not give the patient anything by mouth, no matter how urgently you are asked. To relieve the intense thirst that often accompanies shock, give the patient a moistened piece of gauze to chew or suck. Never give a patient in shock an alcoholic drink or other depressant. A stimulant, such as coffee, also has little value in treating shock. Accurately record the patient's vital signs approximately every 5 minutes throughout treatment and transport. It is essential to transport trauma patients to the ED as rapidly as possible for definitive treatment. The golden period refers to the first 60 minutes after injury, which is thought to be a critically important period for the early resuscitation and treatment of severely injured trauma patients. This concept underscores the importance of rapid evaluation, stabilization, and transport. The goal of EMS is to limit on-scene time, time on scene until transport to hospital is started, to 10 minutes or less. Remember to speak calmly and reassuringly to a conscious patient throughout assessment, care, and transport. Table 10.4 lists the general supportive measures for the major types of shock. Not every measure is used for every type of shock. Treating cardiogenic shock. The patient who is in shock as a result of a heart attack does not require a transfusion of blood, intravenous fluids, or elevation of the legs. There is already a greater volume of blood in circulation than the heart can handle. The damaged heart muscle simply cannot generate the necessary power to pump blood throughout the circulatory system. Keep in mind that chronic lung disease will aggravate cardiogenic shock. If the patient has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and heart disease, oxygenation of the blood passing through the lungs is impaired. Because fluid is collecting in the lungs, this patient is often able to breathe better in a sitting or semi-sitting position and may tell you so. Usually, patients with cardiogenic shock do not have any injury, but they may be having chest pain. Such a patient may have taken nitroglycerin before your arrival and may want to take more. Before helping the patient self-administer nitroglycerin, be sure to consult with medical control for instructions. You will also need to perform an accurate assessment to ensure that the patient's blood pressure meets the criteria for this medication. If the blood pressure is too low, nitroglycerin may increase the problem. Remember that patients in cardiogenic shock usually have a low blood pressure. Other signs include a weak, irregular pulse, cyanosis about the lips and underneath the fingernails, anxiety, and nausea. Treatment of cardiogenic shock should begin by placing the patient in the position in which breathing is easiest as you give high-flow oxygen. Be ready to assist ventilations as necessary and have suction nearby in case the patient vomits. Provide prompt transport to the emergency department. Remember also to approach a patient who has had a suspected heart attack with calm reassurance. Frequently checking for a pulse in an unresponsive patient is important to identify early whether an automated external defibrillator is needed. Treating obstructive shock. As discussed previously, two of the most common examples of obstructive shock are cardiac tamponade and tension pneumothorax. Increasing cardiac output should be the priority in treating cardiac tamponade. As the heart is being squeezed by the increasing pressure in the pericardium, the preload must be increased. Apply high-flow oxygen. Oxygen should never be withheld from a patient who needs it. However, you must weigh the need for positive pressure ventilations against the possibility of hypoventilation. The only definitive treatment for cardiac tamponade is surgery. However, pericardiocentesis, which involves penetrating the pericardium with a needle and withdrawing the accumulated blood from the pericardial sac, is the only practical advanced life support, ALS, pre-hospital approach. This procedure is rarely performed in the field, so early recognition, along with rapid transport or ALS management, if available, is the key treatment available to EMT providers. In treating tension pneumothorax, high-flow oxygen via non-rebreathing mask should be applied early to prevent hypoxia. Be cautious about providing positive pressure ventilation to a patient with a tension pneumothorax, as the increase of air will increase the pressure in the chest. Usually, the only action that can prevent eventual death from a tension pneumothorax is decompression of the injured side of the chest, relieving the pressure in the chest and allowing the heart to expand fully again. Needle chest decompression is a skill many ALS providers are allowed to perform. Rapid transport or ALS management, if available, is the key treatment available to EMT providers. Treating septic shock. The proper treatment of septic shock requires complex hospital management, including antibiotics. If you suspect that a patient has septic shock, you must use appropriate standard precautions and transport as promptly as possible. Use high-flow oxygen during transport. Ventilatory support may be necessary to maintain adequate tidal volume. Use blankets to conserve body heat. Treating neurogenic shock. Shock that accompanies spinal cord injury is best treated by a combination of all known supportive measures. The patient who has sustained this kind of injury usually will require hospitalization for a long time. Emergency treatment must be directed at obtaining and maintaining a proper airway, providing spinal immobilization, assisting inadequate breathing as needed, conserving body heat, and providing the most effective circulation possible. This patient usually is not losing blood. However, the capacity of his or her blood vessels has become significantly larger than the volume of blood they contain. Slight elevation of the foot end of the spine board will help bring the blood that is pooling in the vessels of the legs to the vital organs. Placing the patient's arms across his or her chest without moving the spine will also return some pooled blood. Be sure to monitor the patient for breathing problems and, if they appear, lower the spine board. Supplemental oxygen will boost the concentration of oxygen in the blood. If respirations are weak or inadequate, provide assisted ventilations. Keep the patient as warm as possible with blankets because the injury may have disabled the body's normal temperature controls. Transport promptly. Treating anaphylactic shock. The only really effective treatment for a severe acute allergic reaction is to administer epinephrine by way of subcutaneous or intramuscular injection. For more information on the emergency care for allergic reactions, see Chapter 18, Immunologic Emergencies. A patient who is aware of having a specific sensitivity may carry a bee sting kit containing epinephrine. If he or she is unable to inject the medication, you may have to do so if you are allowed by local protocol. If the patient's signs and symptoms recur or the patient's condition deteriorates, you should repeat the injection after consulting with medical control. Promptly transport the patient to the emergency department while providing all possible support, primarily supplemental oxygen and ventilatory assistance. You should also try to find out what agent caused the reaction. For example, a drug, an insect bite or sting, a food item, and how it was received, for example, by mouth, by inhalation, or by injection. The severity of allergic reactions can vary greatly, with symptoms ranging from mild itching to profound coma and rapid death. Keep in mind that a mild reaction may worsen suddenly or over time. Consider requesting ALS backup if available. Treating psychogenic shock. In an uncomplicated case of fainting, once the patient collapses and becomes supine, circulation to the brain is usually restored, and with it a normal state of functioning. Remember that psychogenic shock can significantly worsen other types of shock. If the attack has caused the patient to fall, you must check for injuries, especially in older patients. However, you should also assess the patient thoroughly for any other abnormality. If, after regaining consciousness, the patient is unable to walk without weakness, dizziness, or pain, you should suspect another problem, such as head injury. You should transport this patient promptly. Be sure to record your initial observations of vital signs and level of consciousness. In addition, try to learn from bystanders whether the patient complained of anything before fainting and how long he or she was unconscious. Treating hypovolemic shock. The emergency treatment of hypovolemic or hemorrhagic shock includes the control of all obvious external bleeding. To prevent continued bleeding, you must apply sufficient pressure to control obvious external bleeding, splint any bone and joint injuries, and ensure that you use great care to handle the patient gently. If there are no fractured extremities, you should place the patient in the Trendelenburg's position, raising the legs 6 inches to 12 inches, keeping the torso in a horizontal position. This will increase blood flow to the heart from the lower body and keep unwanted pressure off the diaphragm. This method combats shock by using the patient's own blood to its best advantage. Although you cannot control internal bleeding in the field, you must recognize its existence and provide aggressive general support. Secure and maintain an airway and provide respiratory support, including supplemental oxygen and, if needed, assisted ventilations. Start the oxygen as soon as you suspect shock and continue it during transport. With too little circulating blood, additional oxygen may be life-saving. Be sure the patient does not aspirate blood or vomitus. Most important, you must transport the patient as rapidly as possible to the emergency department. Treating respiratory insufficiency. In treating the patient who is in shock as a result of inadequate respiration, you must immediately secure and maintain the airway. Clear the mouth and throat of anything obstructing the air passages, including mucus, vomitus, and foreign material. If necessary, provide ventilations with a bag mask device. Give supplemental oxygen and transport the patient promptly.